deterred. Ruby looked pleadingly toward the bartender, who mouthed, "Your problem," and smiled wickedly. "Bill?" she tried. "Billy? Artie? Virgil? Alphonse?"
"Jocelyn."
"Yeah, well, here's the deal," Ruby said, thinking maybe she was starting to sound a little drunk herself.
"I'm not interested, no matter how big and important you or your Johnson might be, okay?" "Mission out."
"My tough luck, Your Honor." He started to slide off his seat, keeping his eyes on her.
"Sayonara," she said, and saluted.
"Semper Fi." He returned her salute and staggered off toward the roulette tables. Ruby ordered a third daiquiri.
"Judicial conference," the bartender said when he put the fresh drink before her. "Not exactly rocket scientists."
"No kidding." She looked toward the gaming tables and imagined a room full of black judges' robes, gavels pounding. She giggled.
"Cutting you off," the bartender said when she raised her hand a fourth time. "You're gonna fall off the bar stool, Red."
"Ruby."
"Ruby Red."
"Okay." Ruby reached into her purse, and her fingers found the surprise of the poker chip Bob Christensen had slipped into the pocket when she wasn't looking. She held it up, evaluated the sexy Sultan's biceps. She had to admit, the Sultan was pretty.
"You got lucky at the dunes today," the bartender said, eyeing her chip.
"I'm not so sure about that."
"Looks that way to me," he said, and then waved off her money. "Just come back and see me sometime. And do me a favor before you hit the street."
"Yeah?"
"Stop by the buffet. Get some food in your stomach. Soak up the alcohol." He must have read her face, because then he added, "It's only $1.99. All you can eat. Just do it, Ruby Red." She stood, unsteady, and then she laid a dollar bill tip on the bar and looked for the women's restroom. The earth was spinning faster than it did in Kansas. Of that, and maybe only that, Ruby was certain.
3. Ruby nursed her first ever hangover by floating on her back in the pool, occasionally opening her eyes to watch clouds travel in wisps above her. The air held a noticeable layer of desert dust, whipped up by overnight winds. She listened to the glug and slurp of the skimmers and tried to muster an appetite so that she'd have energy for the noon audition at the Sahara. When a child's beach ball hit her square in the face, she got out and quickly dressed to catch the bus for the trip to the Sahara, way on the north end of the strip, past Caesar's and the Flamingo, past the Desert Inn, the Riviera, and the Thunderbird. As Ruby descended from the bus in front of the casino, she thought, the Beatles played here, and wondered if she would ever get used to brushing against the famous, or at least their wakes. Next to the tall, vertical sign that said Sahara, palm trees rose like huge lit torches, and the new high-rise section of rooms towered over the city. She passed the camel sculptures with their Bedouin riders, thinking of the movie scene where Anne Margaret and Elvis stood beside the very same camels talking. Bird of paradise flowers nodded their sharp, subtly threatening orange and blue heads at her as she crossed the parking lot. Inside, she saw signs for the conga room, where she knew Dinah Shore performed, but she was looking for the Casbar lounge. Posters announced upcoming shows for the Smothers Brothers and Buddy Hackett. Some of the girls backstage were familiar from previous auditions. Still, everyone kept to themselves, and no one uttered a word, although one girl had the hiccups. Ruby broke the rules, smiled encouragingly at the girl. "Wish I had some peanut butter for you."
"Why?"
The girl hiccuped again, covered her mouth.
"That's what my mother always used, a spoonful. And it worked."
"Stand on your head," another girl suggested.
Hold your nose and drink a glass of water without stopping, someone else advised. It has to be sugar water, another said. Every hiccup remedy known to mankind was mentioned, and for a few minutes, there was camaraderie amongst the competitors. It made Ruby feel good to think that she'd gotten the ball rolling, that being kind was still an option, even in this setting. But the rest of the audition went exactly as the previous ones had. Ruby danced her heart out and was one of the first girls cut from the line. Afterward, as she finished dressing and cramming her dance heels back into her bag, the hiccup girl joined her. "You got cut too?" Ruby asked. "Story of my life," hiccup girl said, slumping into a folding chair beneath the wall phone. "How long have you been at it?"
"Too long," she hiccuped.
"Don't give up," Ruby said, running a brush through her hair.
"Nope, this is it. I decided last night, no more after this."
Ruby sat down beside her, saw that the girl's roots were dark brown and her pink nail polish chipped. "What will you do?"
"Go home."
"Oh, no."
"It's okay. I have a fiancé," the girl confessed, looking into Ruby's face. "The deal was that I could try this for a month, and then, if it was a no-go, I'd come back."
"Where's back?"
"Colorado."
"I liked what I saw of Colorado," Ruby said, from the bus.
"Where are you from?"
"Kansas, Salina."
"Cool."
They sat there, neither one inclined to work any longer at conversation. Finally, hiccup girl got up, stripped off her dance attire, dropped a Hawaiian print muumuu over her head, and slipped her feet into mustard yellow flip-flops.
"Can I buy you a drink?"
Ruby asked, remembering the poker chip in her purse. "At the dunes?"
"Why the dunes?"
"I don't know," she said, not wanting to reveal that she had been on the receiving end of such a huge gift. Or bribe. Or maybe it was bait.
"Actually," the girl said as she picked up her bag, "I'll buy. It's my last night here. Might as well." She sighed.
"Okay," Ruby said, thinking that the girl shouldn't be alone. Besides, it would be nice to have someone to talk to, other than a bartender or a drunk, middle-aged loser in a toupee.
"Let's go to Caesar's," Ruby was suddenly inspired. "I have a friend who might be working tonight."
"Okay, sure. At least I haven't bombed there."
"Me either," Ruby said. "Yet."
Then, thinking she might have jinxed herself, she quickly added, "And I've been wanting to see it."
"Georgia,"
the girl said, extending her hand.
"Ruby."
"Figures," Georgia said.
"What?"
"My hiccups finally stopped." Georgia gave Ruby a lopsided smile. Ruby spotted Rose on duty behind the reception counter. She was wearing a short white toga, gold sandals, and a gold belt. Gracefully curved gold bracelets circled her upper arms, and her hair was piled into a gold barrette with loose tendrils framing her face. Ruby felt tacky, sweaty, and considered skipping the hellos, but Rose saw her and waved her over.
"We've been calling you," Rose said, giving her a hug.
"Hey," she said to Georgia. "Rose, Georgia, and vice versa," Ruby said.
"Daddy and I want to take you to dinner before he leaves town, and tomorrow's his last night."
"Oh, you don't have to."
"You don't have a choice."
"He was going to have me drive him over to the Bombay court and camp out if we didn't get a hold of you soon."
"We're on our way to drown our sorrows," Ruby said, trying to bring Georgia into the conversation.
"No luck?" Rose looked genuinely concerned.
"Not yet," Ruby said, wanting to ward off pity, "but I'm learning."
"Ha!" Georgia blew out a breath, and Rose gave Georgia a puzzled look.
"I just mean," Georgia said, fumbling.
I just meant me. I was thinking about me. Not a comment on Ruby. She's good."
"Georgia's going back home," Ruby said by way of explanation. "She's getting married."
Ruby tried to sound enthusiastic as if she believed marriage weren't Georgia's consolation prize. Rose looked back to the reception counter and nodded at one of the other toga-clad women.
I gotta go. Listen, she said, touching Ruby's elbow lightly. We'll come get you at 6 tomorrow, okay? Daddy hates eating any later.
Sure.
Dress up.
Is that a comment about my present attire? Ruby tugged at her cutoffs and grinned.
He'll want to take us someplace special. Steak. Prime rib. Prawns.
Rose smiled. I've never had prime rib. Or prawns.
Good.
Rose kissed her on the cheek. So glad you stopped by, she said, and Ruby felt a melting in her chest, as if distrust could take a break for a while.
Georgia was a talker. She didn't seem to expect Ruby to do anything other than listen, which suited Ruby fine. From their table against a wall in the bar, Ruby was enjoying watching people, imagining their stories and conversations. Awkward men in JCPenney suits, their wives with cultured pearl necklaces, scuffed handbags, sometimes an abbreviated fur stole despite the summer heat. The women had careful curls, mascara, and penciled eyebrows, but no eyeshadow. Eyeshadow was apparently too slutty for denizens of Minneapolis or Des Moines or Savannah.
Ruby saw lapel pins on the men, Rotary Club, Masonic emblems, American flags. Women leaned in to have their cigarettes lit and trotted off in sadly dependent pairs to find the ladies' restroom. She saw the men in their wives' absence, easily won over by cocktail waitresses and cigarette girls, flashing tan thighs and perky breasts from beneath their perfunctory Caesar's togas. She saw them all so eager to glimpse glamour, their hungry eyes roving in search of even a minor celebrity, someone they could tell everyone back home they'd seen in the flesh this close. Ruby didn't want to live her life in anticipation of one precious, boredom-cracking week a year. A vacation planned for Vegas or our nation's capital or Disneyland. She sipped tonight's foray into alcohol, a rum and cola, and squeezed extra lime into the drink before licking her fingers. She looked at Georgia as she nattered on about domesticity, clearly trying to convince herself that she was headed back to something she genuinely wanted. Ruby imagined Georgia in a few years, seated with her husband in the bar at Caesar's, or trying to spot Tony Curtis pulling up in his Rolls Royce, telling anyone who listened that she'd danced in Vegas, that she'd lived the neon life before she settled down. Settled. That was the key word, wasn't it? As long as I don't quit, everything will be all right, Ruby told herself as Georgia described her fiancé, Sam, the long-haul truck driver. Georgia was worried about having to endure her mother's "I told you so," and she dreamed of owning her own laundromat, maybe a children's clothing store. Or she might manage a shoe store. I'm not Georgia, Ruby swore to herself. I'm not Georgia. I won't quit. Besides, there was nothing, no one, for Ruby to go home to. No Sam. No mother. No home. Rose and her father seated Ruby between them at a table, in the least expensive section, farthest from the stage. Still, it was the Sands Copa Room, where Sinatra performed, and an omni-tan, palmated Dean Martin sashayed his way through Volare, a tumbler of amber liquid perched atop his piano. This, too, was the theater where Red Skelton clowned, his hands animatedly flying about. But what Ruby could not believe was that she was on the verge of seeing, in person, live, sharing the same stale refrigerated air she breathed, Sammy Davis Jr., and the world's greatest drummer, Buddy Rich. Ruby carefully laid the linen napkin across the gold of the dress she'd worn to her Ta-Da dance studio fundraiser, and she relished each mouth-watering bite of the prime rib that oozed deep red juices. Much to Mason's amusement, she blew clean her sinuses with a hefty dose of horseradish and dabbed at her teary eyes, laughing along with him. There were haricots verts, which turned out to be green beans in disguise, and a baked potato packed with butter and sour cream. She sipped a glass of the bold, nearly chewable Cabernet Sauvignon Mason had ordered, and when the lights dimmed and the band struck its initial chords, Ruby looked to Rose and Mason, sending pulses of gratitude to them for their kindness. She felt a near-crazy grin on her face, and she whispered, "My dream come true. You made my dream come true." They smiled, obviously pleased by her joy. Nothing could have prepared her for how small Sammy was. He was a constantly moving, high-speed sprite with a sharply pointed chin and long, thin nose. Short, black suede boots that on him looked right. A gold chain circled one vulnerable, bird-boned wrist, and he peppered his conversation with baby and dig and chick and cool and right on and that cat. He held them spellbound from the moment he speed-walked himself onto the stage, through his verbal riffs, his uber-cool slides and glides, and his head-nodding, thigh-rapping accompaniment to Buddy Rich's drum solos. Cigarette in his right hand, microphone gripped in his left, Sammy sang "That Old Black Magic." Then, without pausing, he grabbed a long shoehorn, slipped into tap shoes, and performed his syncopated version of "Me and My Shadow." Ruby tried to memorize the fluidity of his technique, to think of her feet flying at Sammy's Morse code speed. At one point, the band cut out, and in the silence all she could hear, other than an occasional smoker's cough, was the rhythm he created. Sammy made it look easy. His skill, his sheer athleticism, fueled her love of dance. She felt her dancer's heart revitalized, despite the recent string of failures and disappointments. Sammy Davis Jr. was a hepcat seducer who lured with junky, fast-talking patter. He fed on applause, attention, and like Ruby, he was determined to take the audience captive. He succeeded. They were his. A vast sea of enraptured white faces watched the Negro Cuban boy who had climbed so high that he could audaciously, publicly caress and marry a gorgeous white woman. At the same time, Ruby knew that until just a year ago, he'd been forced to enter and exit Vegas casinos through the kitchen, with the garbage, as he put it. Tonight, in the middle of one routine, he used a falsetto voice to slip, 2, 4, 6, 8, we don't want to integrate, into his riff, and then he kept dancing as if someone else had spoken. Ruby heard nervous, scattered laughter, and she thought about his courage. Sammy Davis Jr. was winning, despite the odds. Ruby adopted Sammy as her god that night. She had all the advantages he had not. She had her savings, her above-grade femininity and beauty, her peaches-and-cream skin, and her automatic white-girl acceptability. How dare she contemplate failure? How dare she imagine following Georgia off of the stage, quitting? No more doubts, she promised herself. No more. When the lights came up and people started making their way out of the Copa and into the main casino for a night of serious gambling, Ruby couldn't stop talking. She hadn't felt this animated in, well, maybe forever.
"You made my day, kiddo," Mason said, patting her shoulder. "To see you smile like this, Rose said you were pretty down."
"I was,
but we took care of that." "You and Sammy," Ruby grinned. "Baby," she said, cocking her head in imitation of the hipster. "Dig this chick," Rose pointed, a la Sammy. Mason held out an arm to each girl. "Shall we?"
They linked arms and walked with Mason through the smoke of the gambling tables, the incessant clanging of the slot machines, and out into the desert night to stand in the parking lot where the asphalt exhaled an endless sigh of unrelenting heat. Ruby imagined the overwarm air filling her skirt, lifting her like a hot air balloon over the strip.
"I'd miss the stars if I lived here," Mason said, looking up. "Can't see a damn thing with all this neon."
"No Big Dipper to scoop ice cream?" Rose said, looking at her father's upturned face, sharing a childhood memory with him.
"I know you love it here, Peanut Blossom, but me," he shook his head, "I prefer the real world."
Ruby lit a cigarette and watched them. She envied them, their closeness, the fact that they could touch each other, physically, or with words, ideas. Rose could ask her father about his childhood, or what he thought about the civil rights movement, or if he liked ground pepper in his tomato juice, or lemon juice, or both. Despite her gratitude, her genuine like of the Maddoxes, Ruby felt a pang of envy. The newspaper headlines screamed the sensational death. Jane Mansfield, 30-time Playboy playmate, film star, and beautiful blonde bombshell, was dead at 34, killed in a horrendous car wreck on a Louisiana highway in the small hours of June 29, 1967. The article was accompanied by a photo of Mansfield, her light blonde hair teased and piled high, her cleavage a joyous shout of sexual promise. Mansfield's car had rear-ended and then traveled beneath a tractor-trailer truck. The three adults in the front seat were killed outright. Mansfield's three children, who had been sleeping in the back seat, survived. Ruby dropped the newspaper, covered her face with her hands. There was her word, the word. Mansfield had been decapitated. It took her breath, made her chest hurt, a crushing pain as if a sledgehammer had struck her breastbone. Ruby could smell hot rubber, gasoline. She could smell blood. She could see Mansfield's rich mane, the blonde strands wetted to each other with clotted blood. She heard wailing, the cries of shocked children as strangers lifted them from the back seat. Ruby opened her eyes, picked up the newspaper, and forced herself to finish the article. There had been several small dogs in the car, too. Some lived, others died. Those poor children, Ruby thought, to lose their pets, too. Bereaved, comfortless, she felt it all again. Time collapsed, disappeared, and she was back on that lonely Kansas highway. There was a photo of the car, the top of it sheared off. Ruby could hear glass fracturing, the sharp, brutal sound of metal shearing. She hadn't known it was there. The memory of that night. The sensations. The smells and sounds. They had lain dormant within her for all these years, to be coaxed to the surface by the eerily similar circumstances of a celebrity's unfathomable death. A few days later, the newspapers corrected themselves. Mansfield had not been decapitated. Someone had mistaken her abundant hairpiece for her head. 4. 3 months of failure. Ruby paid for another couple weeks at the Bombay Motor Court. Counting out the cash on the countertop, she felt a ceaseless, dull throbbing at the back of her head. She'd grown bored with the formerly forbidden magic of TV dinners. The thrill of tossing a perfectly good waxed paper cereal box liner into the trash and imagining Aunt Tate's disapproval had not endured. Ruby was sick of the motel room and the Roger Miller lyrics that flowed pitilessly through her mind. Miller's litany of no phone, no pool, no pets, and no cigarettes. She was tired of television, bored by the interchangeable families that filled the pool every night. She was disillusioned. She was lonely. Ruby got tossed off of the stage at 8 more auditions. The Desert Inn, Riviera, Stardust, Tropicana, and more. She stopped trying to talk to the other girls and made eye contact with no one. She thought about Georgia, an exuberantly green Colorado, about engagement parties, white satin and taffeta, dimpled flower girls with rose petals and patent leather shoes. She mailed another postcard to the aviator and told him to hold off sending the things she'd left in his care. She told him she was looking for a more permanent address while she decided which casino to grace with her presence. She finished with ha 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 ha, which she felt transformed the card from obfuscation to honesty. She hadn't yet cashed in the $100 Dunes chip that Bob Christensen had given her. She'd pull that ripcord when she needed to jump from the burning plane. When the phone rang, Ruby was sitting on the end of the bed, desultorily switching the channel dial back and forth between the dating game and the match game. The fan in her room had first screeched in protest and then broken. The front office had yet to send anyone to fix it, so Ruby was listless with the heat. "Did I wake you?" Rose asked. "Nah, just hot." Ruby wound the phone cord around her bare ankle, pulled it taut. "The girls at my apartment complex are having a spur-of-the-moment barbecue tomorrow afternoon. I want you to come." I know it's short notice." "It's not that." Ruby hadn't realized how down she was, down to the point of feeling nearly completely antisocial. "You'll have a good time. Margaritas and tequila chicken, chips and guacamole. They're a good bunch." "All right." Ruby knew she sounded less than gracious. Lately, she had to work so hard to make herself do anything at all. She squeezed her big toe between her fingers, realized she'd have to muster the energy to shave her legs and fix her toenail polish. "I'll come get you so you don't have to take the bus. And there's someone I want you to meet."
"Please, not a guy," Ruby pleaded.
"No, no, no, it's just us girls," Rose said, managing not to sound defensive.
"Sorry."
"Still no luck, huh?"
"Still an abject failure."
"Well, be patient, and," Rose hurried to say, "I know it's easy for me to say, but I have a feeling about you."
"That makes one of us."
4 o'clock?
"Deal."
"And Rose?"
"Yeah?"
"You're a peach."
"And you're a jewel, Ruby. Don't you forget it."
Vivid carried a glass pitcher of margaritas, richly beaded with moisture. She stopped in front of Ruby and topped off Ruby's glass. Vivid's eyes were hidden behind her sunglasses, but a knowing smile broadened her face as she used one hand to capture some of the droplets from the pitcher. She rubbed her wet hand across her collarbones and then, stretching, languorous, she ran the same wet hand up the length of her neck, circling like a secret beneath her shoulder-length, pitch-black hair.
"Better," she sighed.
Ruby felt her lips part, unbidden, at the sight of Vivid's ripe, Ava Gardner-esque sensuality. She'd never seen a sexier woman. Ruby watched as Vivid threaded her way through the other girls surrounding the tiny, kidney-shaped apartment pool. In her late 20s, Vivid wore tight, Toreador pants that zipped up the side and were cut to sit just below her belly button. The material, a mod floral pattern in reds, yellows, and greens on a white background, had a sheen to it. A cropped, tight, sleeveless white t-shirt and no bra revealed the contours of Vivid's breasts, and her erect nipples were clearly visible beneath the thin cotton. She wore tall wedge sandals, and in her wake, Ruby smelled a rich, heavy perfume that reminded her of her mother's stargazer lilies. Vivid's outfit made Ruby long for a sewing machine and yardage she could stitch into something just as provocative. At the same time, Vivid's lean, flat belly made Ruby realize that she really needed to get back to the nightly sit-ups that she'd let go in exchange for wallowing in front of the motel TV. She looked down at her legs in her cut-off shorts, the utilitarian kids' sneakers that needed to take a spin in the washer. She'd let herself go, as the Salina housewives used to say of each other when they were caught out at the grocery store in curlers or a rumpled blouse.
"Oh, good, you met Vivid," Rose said, perching on the lounge chair next to Ruby. "Scoot over."
Ruby moved her legs to the side. Rose covered Ruby's kneecap with her palm in a familiar, friendly gesture.
"I'll get her over here later so you two can have a chat."
"She's stunning," Ruby said, still stupefied.
"Does she work with you at Caesars? And that's her real name, Vivid? Just Vivid?"
"Stage name. Her real name's Vivian O'Shea. Pure Irish on both sides. Vivid's in the Folies Bergères at the Tropicana, but she's worked almost everywhere. That's why I want for you two to talk. She can help you, really help you, Ruby."
"She's a dancer, then?"
"A showgirl. Topless, yes." Ruby tried to hide her surprise that Rose would encourage her to strip for money.
"I'm not as innocent or as pure as you think," Rose said, accurately reading Ruby's expression.
"I didn't..." "You've mostly seen me when I'm with my father, and for obvious reasons, I have to stay on my toes around him."
So, it was an act. Not Rose's generosity, that was genuine, but the good girl thing, that was a performance for Daddy.
Ruby put her hand on top of Rose's. "You know what? It's a relief. I mean it. A huge relief. Takes the pressure off. You're not perfect after all.
I even say piss and shit and fuck from time to time." Rose grinned.
"She's not telling the entire truth," Vivid said, pulling over a chair and joining them. "When properly inspired, Rose has the mouth of a sailor."
"A sailor on fucking shore leave," Rose laughed.
Ruby could feel the tequila's effects, and maybe it was the company, too. She loaded a chip with guacamole, a taste she could add to her list of new experiences.
"Rose says Bob Christensen singled you out at one of your auditions."
Vivid leaned toward Ruby, and Ruby could see midnight blue highlights in Vivid's hair.
"Is that true?"
"He slipped me $100 chip and his card."
"You say that as if you don't know what it means."
"I guess I don't."
"Guaranteed job, money, clothes, jewelry for starters."
"A car?" Rose added.
"Ha!" Ruby scoffed.
"Look over there."
Rose pointed past the wrought iron fence that separated the apartment pool from the parking lot.
"That's Vivid's convertible."
Ruby spotted a 1967 Pontiac GTO two-door coupe painted a deep, almost navy blue, with a white retractable top and a generous white interior.
"Bob gave you that?" she asked.
"An admirer gave me that. But you're Bob, or Don Arden, or Evan Brashear, or Harold Minsky, or Jack N. Trotter. Those are the men who can, and do, put girls in the position where they can receive gifts like that car."
Ruby didn't say what she was thinking. That she wouldn't sell her body for a car, or the diamond tennis bracelet that clung to Vivid's wrist, or the emerald ring on Vivid's right hand.
"Stand up," Vivid said, her tone direct.
Rose moved aside, and Ruby surprised herself by obeying. Vivid appraised her.
"Bob knows his stuff. You've got it. I can see that. And you auditioned? Bob saw you dance?"
"Yeah, but he didn't hire me."
"Not as a troupe dancer. But I gather he told you exactly where you can make money. With that body, your beautiful features, you can make serious money."
"And," Rose said, "you'd get to wear the most incredible costumes."
"I thought I'd have to parade across a stage naked," Ruby said, sounding archly dismissive. She sat back down on the edge of the lounge chair.
"The vitals are covered. I wear a G-string, pasties, but the rest of the costumes we wear can weigh as much as 70 pounds,
It takes strength, grace, talent to be a showgirl.
Vivid took a sip of her drink and moved her sunglasses to the top of her head. Her eyes were a clear, swimming pool blue.
We're on stage to be admired. It's a long way from prostitution. I sleep with the men I want to sleep with. That's it. No different from any other woman, except I get far more offers than the average. So, Ruby, what I'd say to you is don't knock it till you've tried it.
At least go see Vivid dance, Rose chimed in. You need a job, Ruby, and I don't mean waitressing or cashier work.
Vivid stood, rubbed an unconscious hand across her flat belly.
I have to get out of the sun, she said.
I can't afford tan lines.
She started to walk toward an empty spot at a table beneath an umbrella, but paused to add,
I'm willing to teach you the ropes, and that's a generous offer in a competitive environment. Talk to Rose.
Thank you, Ruby managed.
I'm not doing this for you. I don't know you.
This is for Rose, Vivid said.
I'm offering because Rose asked me.
Ruby could hear the defensiveness in Vivid's voice. She regretted her judgmental attitude, but didn't know how to take it back, and so just looked helplessly between Rose and Vivid before noticing that her own fair-skinned legs had begun to turn pink in the sun. Ruby sat cross-legged on her bed, counting out the remainder of her cash and tallying her projected expenses, including quarters for the dryer, dimes for the washers. She was living on breakfast cereal, canned beans, 4 for $1 frozen pot pies, and boxes of powdered macaroni and cheese, the cheapest things she could find in the grocery aisles. She needed deodorant, lotion, and the heels of her tap shoes cried for the attention of a shoe repairman. She calculated that she had about 2 weeks left before she'd have to cash in the poker chip. After that, she'd be forced to contact the aviator. But she wouldn't. She knew it. Her pride would never let her fully confess failure to him. That's why she said yes when Rose called to say Vivid had complimentary Follies tickets waiting for them at the Tropicana's front desk. The Follies Brigere costumes were beyond anything Dinah Shore could have dreamed of. Skyscrapers of feathers, paste jewels the size of golf balls, chains of bright, multicolored beads dripping in elegant curves from the dancers' outstretched arms. Perfectly choreographed lines of beautiful women lifting long legs, prancing like finely trained Arabian horses, with eyes that glittered from beneath bird-like swathes of bold color. They were utterly feminine, and the fact that their breasts were bare was practically lost on Ruby. So won over was she by their lavish costumes, the extravagant fans of floating ostrich feathers. The band was excellent, and she counted 9 costume changes, including a different pair of sparkly 3-inch heels for each outfit. She watched the women dip, turn. Close-fitting, bejeweled caps obscured their hair and made them all look alike, despite the differences in the curve of a waist, the shape of a breast. She had to look hard to spot Vivid during each dance number, but eventually she recognized the elongated muscles of Vivid's thighs, her broad smile and heart-shaped face.
Over there, Rose pointed discreetly. That's the lead dancer, Patricia LaForge.
Ruby watched LaForge, who did seem to possess a greater level of self-assurance than the others. Ruby found herself wondering if the lead dancer was paid more. What perks came with the title? The dancers performed a number in which they were chess pieces moving about a giant checkerboard. Another number featured a film projected onto a screen behind the stage so that it looked as though the women were accompanied by a dramatically expanded cast. Ruby saw contortionists and even trapeze artists, a breathtaking display of excess that she never could have imagined. Then, in a new segment of the show, a pair of German magicians draped cheetahs across their shoulders as if the wild beasts were heavy fur stoles. Dramatic, handsome men with high cheekbones and hair combed back from their austere faces. They were named Siegfried and Roy, and Rose said they'd been with the Follies for only a few months. Sitting in the dark, watching every turn, every step, Ruby quickly acknowledged the skill it took for a dancer to travel up and down dozens of stairs without looking down, all the while supporting an unwieldy tower of plumage. The numbers were finely choreographed, the floating and revolving formations novel, intricate. In the final number of the show, the girls formed a line and executed perfectly timed high kicks like the Rockettes. Ruby watched with respect as they twirled and yet kept their snow-white tail feathers from crashing into each other. All of Ruby's preconceptions and prejudices fell away that night. She was won over, completely sold. Maybe she could hold on to her dream after all. If she could be hired as a showgirl, she could pay her bills, appear on stage, and dance. At a loss for words when the show was over, she managed only, "Good grief!" "Told ya," Rose grinned. Back in her room at the Bombay Motor Court, Ruby let her excitement grow and dismissed the voice in her head that said it was shameful, bearing her body to gratify men's greedy eyes. She told herself it was Aunt Tate's voice, not her own. This route was a reasonable adaptation to her plan. A way forward. It took courage, she told herself, to reassess, to know when stubbornness and drive were productive, and when it was time to look at things from another angle. Besides, she quite literally could not afford not to try. Not unless she wanted to give up, never be a professional dancer. And Scallywag was no quitter. 5. The Tropicana's showgirl application was short and sweet. Date, name, address, height and weight. Hair color, eye color, complexion. Measurements, dress size, bathing suit size, hat and shoe sizes. Where it asked for her present occupation, Ruby wrote, "Dancer." And she added 2 years to her age. The final few questions required a bit more thought, although the minimal response blanks hardly required an essay. For ambition, she wrote, "To dance professionally and bring audiences pleasure through entertainment." In answer to, "Why did you apply for a Folie Bergère position?" she skipped over the financial truth and instead wrote, "Excitement and glamour." She thought it showed more enthusiasm to capitalize both words. "You decided not to take Bob up on his offer. You're not going to use that connection?" Vivid asked with evident disbelief. "I wanted to work with you," Ruby said, "to learn from you." She hoped Vivid could see how humbled she was, how grateful. Still, Vivid should have warned her, better prepared her. That was all Ruby could think about as she looked at the long table of 6 men, some of them wearing wrinkled suits, others with rolled shirt sleeves, cigarette smoke flowing upward in thin streams from ashtrays that sat next to a stack of showgirl application forms. What Vivid should have told her was that the men would look bored by it all. The man at the center of the table, apparently the one in charge, had a silver crew cut and hound dog eyes that drooped, darkly shadowed. When he called Ruby's name, she quickly chewed and swallowed the remainder of her cert's breathment. She stood before the line of men, keeping one leg slightly in front of the other, turning at an angle as Vivid had instructed her. "Don't stand at attention," Vivid had said, sounding a bit like a drill sergeant. "You're not in the infantry. This is about beauty, Ruby. It's about being a girl." Ruby lit her face with a genuine smile, showing her perfectly aligned teeth and letting her eyes radiate both pleasure and interest in the men who held her future. She thought about all the times she'd put herself on display at Masterson's grocery store, and she made sure she achieved eye contact with each man.
"Where are you from, Ruby Wilde?"
"The Midwest," she said, basing her answer on Vivid's advice to keep things superficial, general.
"And you're a dancer?"
"And a model, back home." Vivid said they'd never check, and that experience as a model would add to her allure, lead the men to think she could walk a runway, know how best to show off her features. They had her parade back and forth, but they didn't ask her to dance. She was wearing her tiny red dancer shorts, a crisp white blouse tied beneath her breasts, and she'd made sure to do a nice job on her nails the night before. Revlon red. Vivid had lent her a pair of black patent leather stiletto heels.
"Turn,"
the lead man said, and Ruby stood with her back to them. She kept her shoulders back, lifted up through her abdomen, showing her full height. She wasn't sure what to do with her hands, and so she held them away from her hips, bent at the wrists, fingertips pointed slightly upward.
"Good. Face us again, Miss Wilde."
Ruby made an elegant turn, eased into a smile once more. She took the fingertips of her right hand and slowly, gently, pushed her hair back from her temple in a purposeful, sensual gesture. Remembering how Vivid had used her hands to cool herself at the barbecue, Ruby closed her eyes briefly and let her hand drift down the length of her neck.
"That's fine," the leader of the pack cleared his throat. "Now, if you don't mind."
He nodded toward Ruby's breasts. The request came as no surprise. Vivid had warned her that there was no other way for the men to evaluate Ruby's true potential as a topless showgirl. Vivid had Ruby practice standing in front of a mirror, envisioning the men watching her. She'd stood naked, staring at herself until she could smile assuredly and know that what she had was worth displaying. Her body should be seen, appreciated, and enjoyed, she told herself. It was just an act. She was Ruby Wilde, performing. Despite all her preparation, Ruby's hands shook slightly as she began unbuttoning her blouse. She knew she should maintain eye contact while she removed her top. And finally she did, at last, untying the knot beneath her breasts without fumbling. Vivid had told her not to wear a bra.
"You want for them to see right away that you're not prudish."
She told herself she'd have to reveal her body to an entire audience, that this kind of scrutiny was only the beginning. But, in a way, an entire audience seemed easier, more anonymous. This was so intimate. Ruby pulled her blouse open and let the cloth drop from her shoulders.
"Remove it entirely, please, and stand in profile."
Ruby held the blouse in one hand, as if she were a model who'd just removed a jacket. She turned, keeping one leg slightly in front of the other, her knees relaxed, slightly bent. She could feel her heart pounding.
"Other side."
She spun.
"Nice," the man said. "Very nice. Everyone?"
the man asked, his voice now sounding less like a physician's or auctioneer's, more like that of someone who had warmed to her. None of the others spoke, and Ruby fought the temptation to sneak a look, to see if they communicated with each other by raised eyebrows, nods, or even shaking their heads no.
"Face us once more, Ruby."
They were no longer bored.
"Now I understand what Renoir was after," the lead man said. "That soft, subtle coloring. Pinks, whites.
Of course no one will see those perfect, quiet areolas.
You have amazing skin," he said.
"But stay out of the sun."
He pointed his cigarette at her for emphasis. Ruby nodded, still smiling. "I will. I do."
"Good. You can get dressed now. See Miss Jenkins backstage. She'll get you scheduled. And Miss Wilde?"
The lead man stood, gave a small bow.
Welcome to the Follies.
Ruby felt as if she'd just stepped off of a cliff. She stood outside in the hallway and tried to catch her breath. She could hear Aunt Tate's infinite disapproval. Almost thought she heard her aunt whisper, "Be careful what you ask for, good Lord." Ruby thought, what on earth had she gone and done? She signed her first showgirl contract, Ruby Wild, a.k.a. Lily Decker, and dated it October 14th, 1967. Then there was a trip to the beauty parlor for a makeover with a Mick Jagger thin man named Toby, who had her stand in front of a full-length mirror while he narrowed his eyes, tilted his head first this way, then that, pushed his chin in the air, and looked at her along the length of his nose. He was wearing a dark red shirt covered in huge white polka dots, a black leather vest, and tight, skinny-legged black pants.
"Splendid color!" he snapped his fingers. "Perfect mahogany hair! Glorious skin!" he effused. "And yes, the Cleopatra looks fine, but let's try something different. Something fabulous! Sit, sit, sit!"
He wet her hair, took his scissors in hand, and began to cut before Ruby had a chance to protest. Could she protest? She rather felt as if she'd been bought and paid for.
"Your neck should be on display, and a short, layered cut will reduce some of the weight of your hair."
At times, using a razor blade, Toby cut her hair so that her ears were exposed, and then he used the tips of his scissors to create what he called wispies around her face.
"It's a shag, honey, all the rage, and I deal with your features."
When he was finished, Ruby had to agree that her eyes somehow appeared bolder, bigger.
"Just fluff it up with your fingers," Toby demonstrated. "Easy peasy, no fuss."
He had delicate hands with calluses on his index finger and thumb, and he wore a polished silver cuff bracelet on his left wrist.
"You'll need hair pieces for variety."
He led her to another section of the salon and seated her once more.
"First, a far-out long piece."
He opened a drawer, and then with his hand still in the drawer, he looked up at her, thinking,
"Black?"
He held up a long fall, placed it next to her face.
"Too dark,"
he said, returning the hairpiece to the drawer.
"Something wild, though. You want to make a statement."
He rummaged through what looked to be the remains of an entire zoo population.
"Bright gold," he decided at last. "I dream of genie."
Ruby grimaced as if she'd smelled decay.
"Just take it."
He dropped the hairpiece in her lap.
"You'll see. Toby is always right."
He smirked, and Ruby was won over. After piling six hairpieces of different colors and configurations in her lap, he sang,
"Makeup!"
and led her back to the salon chair where they'd begun.
"After today, you'll have to do your own."
He opened a chest of drawers that reminded her of Uncle Miles' giant metal toolbox, except that it was hot pink. The drawers were filled with eyeshadow, eyeliner, and eyebrow pencils, foundation, mascara, blush, and powder.
"Extend your eyeliner like this," Toby said,
expertly drawing the line up and out from the outer corner of her eye.
"Go like this."
He opened his mouth into a huge O, and Ruby copied him while he flicked mascara onto her lashes.
"The trick the girls use," he said,
opening a package of false eyelashes,
"is three pairs. Three."
"But how does anyone see through that much eyelash?"
"You get used to it. It's the only way to have your eyes pop, even from a distance. And pile on the rouge like this."
He showed her how to apply the rouge below her cheekbone and to angle it steeply upward.
"Use a darker color of rouge and lipstick than you normally would. Overdo everything. That's my motto," he laughed. "And girl, I do mean everything."
Ruby smiled back at him in the mirror.
He'd transformed her. She felt like some rare tropical bird.
"One more trick," he said, handing her a roll of flesh-toned tape. "Know what this is?"
"I haven't a clue."
"It's toupee tape. Okay, stop," he cautioned, as Ruby began to giggle. "This is dead serious."
Still, he began laughing along with her.
"So anyway," he said, finally catching his breath, "you use this to hold your G-string in place. It can't be seen if you do it right, and shifts in the old G-string can be, well," he smiled lasciviously.
"Plus, I need to do some serious hair removal," Ruby said, feeling daring.
"Daily."
Toby of the Bottomless Energy loaded her with a fully stocked makeup kit in colors that best suited her complexion and a set of soft bristled brushes in an array of sizes and shapes. And then he passed her on to Gloria Jenkins, the Tropicana's showgirl manager. "All the girls call me Mother J," Gloria said, beckoning Ruby into her white Ford Falcon. "I take care of everything, and you can come to me anytime. Any time. For advice or whatever." Gloria took Ruby shopping. For evening gowns, cocktail dresses, mini skirts, blouses, brightly colored tights and fishnet stockings, bell-bottom pants in audacious pinks and oranges, as well as pale celery and aquamarine, and even lacy red and black lingerie. Uninvited, Mother J came into the fitting room with Ruby, narrowed her eyes, and expertly tugged at bra straps, ordered clerks to bring different sizes. She had Ruby bend over to get her breast firmly seated in the bra cups, and as Ruby dressed and undressed, Gloria took note of Ruby's sizes in a little black spiral-bound notebook.
"Shoes," Gloria said, and they were off to High Style Footwear, a store that catered to the casino crowd. "Miss Jenkins, Miss Jenkins, enchanté."
A man with a thin mustache greeted them at the entrance.
"This is the new girl you phoned about."
He bowed to Ruby, and, like a maitre d' at a fine restaurant, ushered them toward a row of chairs.
"We'll take very good care of you," he promised,
snapping his fingers until a clerk appeared at his side. This clerk, too, took orders from Miss Jenkins.
"One pair of flats, plain, black, some short black boots, moderate heel, heeled sandals, the rest fashion heels, and the usual order of capizios. Oh, what am I saying? You know," she said, waving a hand.
Mother J purchased 10 pairs of shoes for Ruby. Ruby's favorite was a tall pair of minimalist heels with a strap that circled her ankle. The silver shoes were open-sided, open-toed, and the only thing holding the shoe to her foot, other than the heel cup and ankle strap, was a narrow band of rhinestones in the shape of a loosely tied knot. They were supremely elegant Cinderella shoes, and it was all Ruby could do not to plead like a little girl to keep them on her feet, maybe even to sleep in them.
"How are you feeling?" Mother J asked when they got back into the Falcon.
She rolled down her window and Ruby did the same. Once the car was moving, there was enough of a breeze to begin to cool them.
"I keep thinking I'll hear a clock strike midnight and everything will disappear. I hope Toby remembered to give you some good facial moisturizers. This dry air is murder on the skin. The singers all complain about desert throat."
"I think he put some jars in the case," Ruby said. "It's a little hard to keep track of everything at this point." Mother J flicked the lever for her turn signal and pushed in the cigarette lighter.
"Go ahead. I don't, but you go ahead. I know how you girls manage to keep those figures."
Ruby felt instantly calmer with the first lungful of tobacco smoke, and she settled back in the seat, looked at the blue mountain range lurking in the distance, across the desert flats. Mother J broke the brief silence.
"Understand, please, Ruby, what we bought today. These are your work clothes, your uniforms. You're expected to entertain after the show.
You keep the men gambling, buying drinks, food. Basically, she said, turning to look at Ruby, you keep them spending money, and you give them a good time. Let them brush up against glamour.
I was talking with Vivid, Ruby began.
Good, good. She's experienced, a good girl to go to for advice.